Hey everyone out there, and thanks again for joining us here at ASAP Nowcast, the podcast for ASAP Now. It is fall already, and hopefully everyone has recovered from a great scientific assembly in Utah, because I'm ready to jump right back into some great clinical content. For those of you that followed us for a bit, you know that every month at ASAP Now, we feature something for you, either from the magazine or something that's on the podcast only. And this month, I wanted to do a deeper dive into one of the clinical cases in the magazine. Emergency medicine is a specialty of intervention. We like to intervene, in theory, because it's why the patient is in the ER, since they have an emergency that probably needs an intervention. But I think it's a good reminder to all of us that all interventions, no matter how small, have the risk of complication. Iatrogenicity is kind of what we call it. For the big things that we do, like surgeries or big procedures, we have a discussion of that risk, which is consent. But for some of these routine interventions, needle sticks, IVs, labs, imaging, we don't really think about it because it's so commonplace in our field. So have a listen to this case report that I promise is about something that we have all done on a patient. Hey everyone here at ASAP Now, thanks again for joining us. So we have with us this month, Dr. Neerajan Nepal, who's a third year emergency medicine resident at Madigan Army Medical Center. So Dr. Nepal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Ho. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. As you said, my name is Neerajan Nepal. I am a third year emergency medicine resident at Madigan Army Medical Center, which is located in Joint Base Police McCord at Tacoma, Washington, and I'm also a graduate of Uniformed Services University. Just to note, all the views that I'm expressing today is my own and does not reflect the Department of Defense, the Department of the Army, the U.S. government, or the Madigan Army Medical Center.
So we will, of course, happily take the disclaimer, but I was telling you, as I was preparing for this interview and reading the case report, I realized that you're actually the first person I've ever had on the podcast who had a military career in medicine. And, this was actually a case that you saw as part of that. So I would love if you would just tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit of how you ended up in emergency medicine, how you ended up in the services. Of course, thank you for your service, before we jump right into the case.
Yeah. So actually, I did not directly validate this patient, but I will get back to that. So I was born and raised in Nepal. I came here after high school for college. I finished my college from Kutztown University, and eventually ended up joining the military. I was enlisted for a few years. Then subsequently, that guided me my pathway for medicine, which obviously I went to Uniformed Service University. I remained in active duty during that time as well. And emergency medicine hit home, fell in love every bit of it. That was a mix of the third world medicine that I encountered in the early part of my life, and obviously the passion I had for military medicine that just kind of brought it together. And that's what I'm pursuing right now.
Well, wonderful. And it makes so much sense that, an interest in the services in the military would mean an interest in emergency medicine. One of our core tenets of triage is literally from the military. So I love that there's so much of that dynamic in this case. So let's open with, where was this patient from? Give us a little background.
So yeah, as I said before, I actually did not directly validate this patient. This case was one of my attendings, a personal case during his deployment. When I reviewed and discussed the case with him later, I realized how striking it was. Especially it started from such a routine procedure, which is just peripheral IV insertion. It really drove home the point that even something as benign as just peripheral IV can surprisingly cause a dangerous chain of reactions subsequently into pulmonary embolism. And obviously, this was in the setting of deployment where the environments are different, where the small problems can become a big one pretty fast.
Yeah, and I think I was taking a lot of parallels. You talked about how it was an austere environment. It was during an Afghanistan deployment. You know, I had never really thought about this, but because everyone who's in military medicine that I've ever met has been, you know, stateside at a base, because obviously that's the only way that I would meet them. But that, yes, you guys go out into the field and get deployed. And, you know, it had me think that only recently has medicine gotten really interested in social determinants of health, where like, hey, if you don't have follow-up, if you don't have all these things, if you don't have resources, maybe your medical diagnosis is going to turn out differently than if you're at the giant tertiary urban medical center. And I realized that military medicine is probably vastly like that. So, you know, I think I'm kind of running forward. So let me back up. Talk us through the case.
Sure thing, Dr. Ho. So this case report basically presents a 39-year-old male who was deployed. He is an active duty service member in Afghanistan who initially presented with acute gastroenteritis. He was treated with some IV fluids. There was a peripheral line in his right arm in his cephalic vein. A few days later, he noticed some palpable cord. Initially thought it was like just local reaction, which we call superficial thrombophlebitis. But later on, like, you know, given the concern, like, you know, the bedside ultrasound was performed. Obviously, we can't get a consultative ultrasound in the deployed setting. There was a clot that was seen that was extended from the cephalic vein into the axillary system, confirming, like, you know, this could be potential DVT. And he was started on low molecular weight heparin and later on switched to anticoagulation, which was Xarelto in this case. After evacuation to the higher facility, he had further diagnostic imaging, which is CT scan of his pulmonary angiogram and pulmonary arteries, which showed there was extension into the subclavian vein and had a multiple right-sided segmental PE, which is pulmonary embolism. The pulmonary embolism from upper extremity DVTs are pretty rare, likely because most of the upper extremities veins are smaller. And the clots are less prone to embolize compared to those in the legs, which we mostly encounter. But in this case, the cephalic axillary junction likely gave the thrombus a direct conduit to the central circulation. That's the junction is. Interestingly, he also had a prior superficial thrombophlebitis in the same region years earlier, which could also, the hypothesis is like probably there's some sort of like local scarring, valvular damage that set the stage for this event.
So it's really interesting to me because we do millions of IVs a year, right? Like across the United States, probably more than millions in emergency medicine. And I wanted you to tell me, what are your thoughts in terms of how much of this happened because he was deployed, he was, you know, in a little bit of an austere environment, and how much this could probably just happen anywhere? Like, this actually made me really think about, man, like, should we always be putting in IVs? And then also, man, should I be treating superficial thrombophlebitis a little bit differently?
Absolutely. This could happen in civilian hospital. When I was preparing for this case, like, you know, case report, it was in the back of my head. I wanted to write it down and submit the case report. I was obviously rotated in a lot of neurocritical care ICUs, medical ICUs. And I've seen a few cases of upper extremity DVT, especially in critically ill patient, ICU patients, when they are not anticoagulated because the concern is some sort of like, you know, bleeding risk, subdural hematoma versus subarach. So I have definitely seen this in real life. And obviously this case made me more humble about the small benign procedure that can eventually cause into some devastating risk. In deployed setting, the risk factors are also stacked up. Usually there's a lot of field training exercises that can cause dehydration. There's heat issues with all these deployments we had in the Middle Eastern region in the past. There's obviously soldiers are living in close quarters. There's a hygiene-related infection versus close quarter infection. High altitude could play another factor as well. And obviously like limited diagnostic capabilities, so something can linger for a long period of time. A small endothelial injury might be resolved uneventfully in the civilian setting and can be monitored more closely, but definitely can snowball in the field setting. So as this case is like in probably a more perfect storm of like systemic stress, there's limited monitoring, delayed imaging, and that turning to a routine IV into a like textbook case of some Virchow's triad in action.
Sorry. And I was actually completely floored by your stat of 20 to 30% of patients with the superficial venous thrombuses can progress to DVTs, especially when it's near the junction of a deep vein. Like, I mean, that's a line from your case report. I was like, wow, maybe we should really think about these a little bit differently. I would actually love to get your thoughts on that. So obviously in this case, he had to be taken out of the field because he needed to be on a blood thinner and, of course, you know, get advanced diagnostics. But what were your thoughts on this after, you know, doing the lit review and going through this case on should we manage superficial thrombophlebitis differently? I mean, frankly, I've never seen another DVT from a superficial thrombophlebitis. This is a great case report, I thought, for that reason. It sounds like you've seen this other in other situations, but you're looking at a young, healthy population where this is happening for. So I'm wondering what happens in a less young, healthy population.
Totally. I think this gets a little bit more nuanced than we realize in clinical settings. For most isolated and distal superficial thrombosis, I think supportive care is fine, which is basically warm compress, NSAIDs, observation, like, you know, follow-up care is enough. But when the clots gets near to the junction, especially when the deep system, deep venous system, likely in this case was a cephalic axillary connection, or the patient has other systemic risk factors, the risk factor that we discussed in this case was in the third citation, we said, like, in the progression of the DVT jumps into 20 to 30%. The paper talks about two different kinds of studies. There was a post study and the OPTIMIV study. The post study was prospective observational superficial thrombophlebitis study, which demonstrated that SVT was related to almost 24.9% of DVT or PE. And the OPTIMIV study said 28.8% of the patient had SVT, also had a DVT. And I think it's reasonable. That's why I kind of totally, like, you know, have enough experience with the inpatient medicine, but the experience I had like all these patients getting DVT prophylaxis. But it's also reasonable for these patients to have a discussion about if it's close to the venous, deep venous system, to have anticoagulation versus at least close observation or repeating consultative ultrasound. So I think the bottom line is if it's close to the deep venous system, that's a red flag. We should definitely consider anticoagulation, or at the very least, we should have close imaging follow-up for these patients.
And I think that's probably a great takeaway that I took from this was pay attention to where your superficial thrombophlebitis is. I think a lot of times we see it on ultrasound. We're like, hey, superficial, move on. Or we get it on a radiology report and we're like, oh, superficial, move on. But, you know, have a moment to pause and think about what is the risk of this progressing into something larger. Like, that was actually a bit of a practice changing takeaway from me on this case, which is why I really wanted to talk to you about it, Dr. Nepal. I would love to also highlight, I think, a very interesting point about military medicine, which is that you mentioned that he was taken out of his Afghanistan deployment because he was placed on Xarelto. When I was reading that, I realized, hey, there's probably a lot of things you can't be on if you're deployed. And, you know, we may not see, you know, active military, you know, service people in our civilian hospitals always. But if we do, I think it's really important for us to be sensitive to that. Like, as an example, I'm in a major, major pilot hub because there's a couple airlines that station where I am. So I know very strictly like what I can and cannot start a pilot on without it causing major impact to their career. So I would love to understand a little bit of detail about like meds or diagnoses that mean something for someone who is deployed.
I think readiness is a big part of military medicine. And particularly in this case, the anticoagulation was likely the main driver for evacuation. I do not clearly know was there's concern for PE at that time or not, but in deployed setting, anyone who receiving a new dose of full anticoagulation is typically sent out of theater because the bleeding risk and also the difficulty to safely monitor, or if you need a reversal, like, you know, these are all very logistically challenging. And you can imagine in Austrian environment, that is probably not gonna happen. And there are a lot of other medical evacuation, which includes like any new long-term condition that is diagnosed or that cannot be managed in the field. This probably goes into more logistical details. Things like acute surgical cases, like appendicitis, cholecystitis, new onset like seizures, DKAs, new insulin-dependent diabetes, severe psychiatric illness, any critically ill patient, obviously traumatic or medical. But obviously, we also have to consider that every evacuation decision is balanced based on the medical safety and the missing needs. Process like it involves both the treating physician and command approval. Obviously, the safety takes the precedence for the evacuation as well. It can get a little bit murky, but I think it's in between navigating logistics and the operational priorities. So I can't give you like probably a clear answer, but it definitely like, you know, any a new diagnosis that needs a lot of logistical support usually get evacuated.
And I think that's actually something that is helpful, right? Like, I think about a patient and what they're doing in their career. In this case, if you're getting deployed in the field in potentially very dangerous situations, hey, you know, if we're going to start these medicines or if you need this further workup, does that mean that you can't be, you know, being on that medicine or get an additional workup or have a diagnosis? I think this is just something to consider for this patient population that I found really unique that I really appreciate you sharing. So I wanted to close with just a couple takeaways that you had after this case report, whether it's about military medicine, whether it's about superficial thrombophlebitis that you would like for our audience to have after listening to this. And of course, checking out the case report on ASAP Now, which is called Case Report Rare Pulmonary Embolism After Routine PIVC Insertion.
I think the biggest takeaway for me from this paper is this case is a reminder that routine is only routine until it is not. No procedure is truly benign. Even routine tasks like, you know, inserting IV, which we do millions of times throughout the year, occasionally states into some sort of dangerous chains of reaction, especially in the wrong environment. Contexts do matter. If the patients are, dehydration is one of the big factors, as we discussed in this case, infection, prior venous injuries, patients who are critically ill in ICU or inpatient beds, patient we cannot anticoagulate based on some bleeding risk factors, or give any DVT prophylaxis. These all amplify, like, you know, this thrombotic and thromboembolic risk factors. And whenever there's a concern, if there's superficial thrombophlebitis, but there's some pain, palpable cords proximal to the thrombophlebitis, I think its ultrasound is kind of warranted. It basically makes us think back to this Birdshaus triad with any IV insertion that there is a endothelial injuries. Obviously, stasis is a factor because these people are sick. They're less mobile. It doesn't have to be that 19-hour flight. Just patients are ill and they're in the couch or in the bed. And obviously, all this illness increases the hypercoagulable risk factors. So we must consider all these risk factors and a low threshold to treat, or at least closely monitor for any thrombus close to the deep venous junction.
Very, very cool case from Dr. Neerajan Nepal, thanks again for sharing with us, because I think this is something that we could all relate to, as I can't imagine any of us working a full ER shift without at least one IV on any given month. So thank you again for sharing.
Thank you, Dr. Ho, and thank you for your team for the opportunity to share the case.
That's it for us this month. And as always, there is tons more in the magazine. We are digital this month, so all your favorites can be found on the website at asapnow.com. We've got some content on recent happenings, like a disaster medicine preparedness article of the Boston Marathon, and another article on how emergency medicine came together in the LA fires. We've also got a cool feature about navigating healthcare in another country, Vietnam. And wow, reading that article, it feels so different from the US system. And as always, we have tons of additional clinical content. There's a great piece on pre-hospital tourniquets with Dr. Turner, a quick and dirty critical care time with our prior guest, Dr. Paul Janssen, on non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. And of course, some practice of medicine pearls on the business of EM, the job market as it is today, and how AI is layering into our practice. As always, tweet us if you got an idea at ASAP Nation, or feel free to tweet me direct at Amy Faith Ho. We would love to hear your thoughts and feedback and keep you tuning in. So thanks everyone for joining us, and we will see you all next time.